Hello there and welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Pro Podcast. As always, I am George Breer. I'm head of events content here at Sports Pro, and alongside me in a habitual state and mustachioed newly is Mr. Tom Bassam, Sports Pro's off-platform editor. Tom, it's good to be joined by you as always.
Good to be joining you, George. I feel like I'm seeing a lot of you today. Lifting up behind the curtain, this might be a double pod recording for us today, but I can't get enough of it, and I hope you can't get enough of it too.
It nourishes my soul, that kind of thing, Tom. But because we already struggle to maintain a conversation of longer than 5 minutes between the two of us, we have brought in a mediator extraordinaire in Josh Sim, Sports Pro's reporter. Josh, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, George. If you guys need, I'll happily go on a big monologue about something, I'm sure.
You're always welcome. We know that. Now, one person or a couple of people that aren't welcome to the Premier League's financial fair play party are Nottingham Forest and Everton. So before we go into the details, Josh, can you give me a quick rundown of the cans and cannots when it comes to financial fair play in the Premier League?
Sure. So the Premier League regulations currently say that clubs in the Premier League can lose a maximum of £105 million over a three-season period, which equates to about £35 million per campaign. If they exceed that limit, then they are at risk of facing sanctions, and these could be range from a fine to a points deduction, as Everton have already discovered earlier this season. The Premier League have now found that Everton have again exceeded that limit, and now Nottingham Forest have joined that party and sort of have broken the rules as well.
Now, Everton's breach, is that a second separate breach? Because I know their argument relates to it being essentially a double charge for the same thing.
Yeah, so they are currently appealing. They are in the process of appealing that previous charge that has already seen them lose 10 points. They are sort of claiming that this is the same financial period, is their argument, that a separate sanction has been brought against. So why, I guess they would be arguing, why are there two sanctions for the same period?
Now, Tom, it's a pretty strange situation when two clubs are charged for an offence or in the process of being punished, but there's two words on everyone's lips, and that's Manchester City. Why is that?
That's because Manchester City have a hell of a lot of charges. 115, is it?
I believe so.
Which remain outstanding.
More charges than they're allowed to lose over three seasons.
Exactly that. They have a lot of charges outstanding. These were announced last January, conveniently at a time when the Premier League was trying to push back against how much control the new English football regulator was going to have. I don't quite know if there's a link between those two things, but I'll just leave that there. That's the kind of the big looming thing, the backdrop of this. The reports I'm reading are that those cases, because there's so many of them, because of the fact that Manchester City are lawyered up to the wazoo in here, that that won't be resolved until probably the end of next season, by which point some of those charges could be well over a decade old. It does seem kind of a little bit like there's one rule for them and then new rules for everyone else right now.
For those that are watching this podcast on camera will see that I am smirking uncontrollably on account of Tom's slipped in succession reference there, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Now, Josh, moving away from the specific charges themselves, financial fair play as a whole, it's beginning to sort of show its teeth, potentially.
You could argue that it is sort of allowing the clubs that have been traditionally, I guess, rich for a while to sort of maintain their position at the top. Nottingham Forest fans obviously know that they've made a lot of signings as a sort of a challenger, you know, coming out of the Championship to sort of stay in the Premier League. And eventually, I know they have European ambitions, but they are now have fallen foul of this while trying to challenge. And yeah, it does mean that those teams that have been wealthy at the top for a while are less likely to face challenges if said challengers are going to be struggling with being able to keep up with the financial rules of the Premier League.
Is there an argument, though, that essentially more financial sustainability needs to be the benchmark for protecting those in the bottom half of the table? So that if the solution to, you know, Premier League viability essentially in the long term is to way overspend your limits, essentially you have a financially unsustainable league as a whole.
It is true that these rules coming in do sort of help ensure that those teams that are essentially sort of transitioning into the Premier League and then sort of there around the 3-year, 4-year mark are able to sort of stay again healthy and are not sort of prone to sort of overspending beyond their means. I know it's a tricky tightrope for the league because obviously, yeah, it wants to have these financial controls in place, but also it does mean that we do sort of have a league that doesn't really see a lot of changes in terms of where teams are in the pecking order. And obviously in the backdrop, we have this independent regulator that is supposed to come and help manage all the financial problems that English football has, but that's still in the process of being made by the UK government.
Yeah, I think we can come on to the football regulator. Kind of what gets lost in all of this, and we talk about the murky world of football finance, is that we're talking about how much money clubs are allowed to lose. These are, in some cases, businesses that turn over hundreds of millions of pounds. Why are they arguing over how much money they're allowed to lose? That shouldn't be the way that a successful business operates. And look, I know football is a unique thing. Clubs need to spend money in order to put players on the pitch, acquire new players, maintain facilities, build youth academies. They're not like a retail store or a post office. They have to, I guess that's kind of quite prevalent at the moment with the news cycle.
Always have your finger on the pulse, don't you, Tom?
Fundamentally, we're talking about teams arguing over how much money they can lose in a certain period of time. I think what these rules are trying to do, and like seemingly like starting to show their teeth on, is to try and get the football industry to think differently about how they operate. It's also not impossible for clubs to bridge some of these gaps without losing these kind of sums. What they're trying to do is set up a system whereby player trading becomes like something that is actually part of your business. Find new ways of generating revenue. You mentioned Manchester City, and like the thing about this whole stuff is that it's come too late to regulate Manchester City. Manchester City are the team that should have been hit by these rules, but they were lucky enough to come under new ownership and come under very well-moneyed ownership in a period where there wasn't so much regulation. They may ultimately be hit with some pretty severe sanctions, we don't know yet. This is basically designed at making sure that that cannot happen again. But it doesn't necessarily rule out, I don't think, the idea that a club can make a leap if they do so in a way that is responsible. It doesn't need to be like absolutely mind-blowing. You've only got to look at clubs like Aston Villa, like Brighton, who sell in order to generate revenues, and then they reinvest some of that into their teams. Brighton still lose money. Aston Villa are still losing money. They both have wealthy owners. What this will do, I think, over a period of 2 to 3 years probably, is just correct how the market works.
Because I think that's one, Man City's always mentioned in this conversation, but it is important to clarify that they are charged with separate breaches, right? I don't think Man City are being charged with losing more than 105 million over 3 seasons. It's their accounting systems, is my understanding, is the way they're reporting revenue, the way they're reporting loss and costs, etc., is under scrutiny. And is being questioned. And that's an issue of immense complexity as well. It's over quite a long period of time, I believe, as well. So you do slightly need to not compare apples and oranges here, to use a piece of horrible business jargon. But actually, it's about almost protecting the bottom of that pyramid, not allowing it to just fall out of the league, essentially, which happens with, you know, mass spending and unregulated spending, particularly when, in the case of Everton, that's at an unsustainable level, so that when an ownership is sanctioned or when ownership is, you know, on a whim decides to no longer invest, it leaves the club with an enormous hole that's impossible to fill.
Yeah, but Everton also enjoyed that period of time when there was less regulation. They did spend a lot of money and they spent it really badly. Like, there are several deals that you could point to where they overpaid and weren't able to move players on. There were several where they were unlucky too. But like, Everton is an example of a team that has been badly run over the last 3 to 5 years. And that's who kind of should be being punished. Like, this won't be a popular statement with Everton fans at all. They're saying it's unfair that they're getting points deductions. Well, it's also unfair to all the teams that do abide the rules and then other teams are able to just get away with it. We come back again to Manchester City because they're the ones that have got away with it. But as you said, George, they are a different proposition in all of this. I guess the team for me, who this is kind of probably most directly got in its crosshairs is Newcastle. Newcastle, similar to Manchester City, now owned by a sovereign wealth fund, in this case, Saudi Arabia. Since it's been taken over, the club has been trying to find ways to generate those revenue increases that have allowed Manchester City to not be at risk of coming up against these profit and sustainability rules. Like, Manchester City can invest in their squad year on year because they generate X amount in income. Newcastle can't yet do that. They're definitely trying to get there. They may follow even some of the same models that Manchester City do. They're well on their way.
A 40% increase in the last year on their annual revenues.
Exactly. But then they've still got Darren Eales, their CEO, saying, we are limited this month what we can spend because of profit and sustainability rules. That's probably
on
right.
On players. It's interesting to look at the numbers because their operating profit is now 20 million. And that's up from a £26.5 million loss. And these are reported figures, I should add. I do not have insights into Newcastle's accounting. But that's nearly a £50 million swing, which is an extraordinary swing by any business's margin, particularly when you're talking about a 200% increase on profit margins, right? Or 200% swing on profit margins, I should say. But that being said, player amortization, so essentially the cost of transfer fees in that window, is £90 million. So you have a business that on paper anyway is well run, is profitable, is sustainable, yet you have player trading that plunges it into more than nearly double what the season loss permitting is if you account over that 3-year window of 35 million.
Yeah, and the thing about that is that's partly in the way that they've bought. I mean, they've spent like 400 million, I think, since being taken over. And that happens in a short space of time. You don't get much chance to spread that out over many years unless you do what Chelsea have done. And now that loophole's been closed too. Newcastle could have done that. They could have amortised those deals over 8 years. It is an increased risk. We're seeing it with Chelsea at the moment. They've got a lot of players on eight-year contracts who probably might not be there in 2 to 3 years. Like, Newcastle didn't want to go down that route. They could have. They might not have even thought of it because it was pretty new when Chelsea did it. These are all ways that you can play with the system. For me, it feels like Everton and Forest thought that they were working within some of those boundaries and they've fallen foul of them. Like, I think in order for any regulatory system to work properly, it has to be shown to have teeth. And if a Premier League wants to take this kind of stuff seriously, which I think it does, or it's trying to, especially with the looming threat of someone else coming in and telling them how to do it, that they're trying to show that we've got a handle on this.
Do you not think there's an argument to say that the breaches that Man City are accused of and some of the other loopholes that you've alluded to, i.e. inflated sponsorship value, for instance, or, you know, underpaying essentially members of leadership, which I know Kieran McGuire, when he's come on this podcast, has talked about previously, they're much more serious crimes or much more serious charges than essentially, I'm not saying it's as innocent as this, but someone like Forrest and Everton holding their hands up and say, yes, we got this wrong, we have overspent, but we're admitting to that. Is there not a case of, rather than saying to Everton that, let's say, is running at a massive loss, we're going to relegate you to the Premier League with another points deduction and therefore put you even further adrift from being remotely sustainable and actually just carry on the rot? Is there not a case to say, okay, you've overspent by whatever it is, you are therefore under transfer embargo until all your spending is capped at a certain amount, almost in the style of La Liga, and say instead you need to focus on your business operations being more profitable? And actually, if it's only player sales and only player trading that is causing that financial mismanagement, well, then that's what needs to be capped and the business itself needs to be protected. Whereas you have someone like a Man City, allegedly their business is misleading, or the reporting of their business misleading. And obviously, another caveat here, these are alleged breaches and still to be proved. That's a far more serious and worrisome issue.
Yeah, transfer embargoes we've had before. Chelsea have been under transfer embargo in the last 5 years during Frank Lampard's probably best season as a manager, I'd say. And he was forced to deal with that. I think it's just a case of that.
So why has that been stopped?
I think these are just viewed as trying to have more teeth to these things. Like, if you do that, then the punishments have got to be severe. So going back to the original point that I made, like, if you are losing 105 million over 3 years, like, that's not good for your industry in general, right? So, like, and that is probably a bigger problem and therefore deserves a harsher punishment than a transfer embargo, which, like, simply impacts like your ability to bring in more players and spend more money.
But the punishment isn't solving the crime. And I'm using crime here in a comparative sense. But the problem here is overspending on player transfers. it's not on a mismanagement of business operations, from what I understand. But, so why would you punish the business operations when therefore you're still able, you'd still be able to transfer players? If the problem comes from player sales, why would that not be where the punishment is directed? Instead, you're essentially going to relegate a team, or you're going to fine them, which only serves to impact the business operations, which by all accounts are healthy.
Well, it depends what you view as healthy. Like, if a business requires you to lose that much money in order to be successful, then is that healthy? I don't know.
Can you separate business and team there, though?
I don't
think... The business's success and the team's success are different things.
But I don't think Everton are a successful business. They were reliant for a long time on the money of a quite shadowy investor from Russia. That ended up actually costing them. Like, they lost sponsors. They had to scramble around for new deals on lower rates. The only thing really that they've managed to kind of successfully do in the last few years is get their stadium built. That's not finished yet. They haven't even managed to successfully complete a takeover, because the person that Farhad Moshiri is seeking to do a deal with remains under scrutiny from like regulators and authority figures over ratifying that deal. Saying that they're a successful business because that side of it has brought in some money doesn't necessarily mean that they are. Like, it's, to me, Everton are the archetype of a badly run football club.
Well, maybe we'll agree to disagree on that one in the interest of time. Josh, did you
want to... I think it's the point that you sort of said about sort of not wanting to penalise the business side or penalise the team side instead. I don't know, it just comes a bit of a slippery slope. Like, who's, say, Arsenal has three performance people and Everton have five, and Arsenal are spending less, and who's to say that, you know, it's one entity and all these sort of things play into part of one entity. So then to sort of separate the team and business and say you can't do transfers but you're able to sort of business, I feel like that's a slippery slope of then trying to work out, like, you know, what should there be individual caps on, like, wages for staff versus wages for players. Like, it then becomes...
It's impossible to church and state between performance, I think so, and business.
And then there'll be teams that sort of are doing well on, like, very low wage budgets, for instance, or spend it, they allocate their resources differently. So I see what you're sort of saying. I just would also find it hard to sort of implement in practice.
Do you think, just to tie a bow in this, do you think that this is going to show the teeth at the Premier League needs for these rules to be respected by other clubs? Do you think this is an important stepping stone?
I actually really do. Yeah. I think in a few years' time, we might still see teams falling foul of these kind of things, but I think they will learn. If 2 to 3 teams get hit with points deductions for a season, 2 seasons, come season 3, people are going to learn that, like, you can't get away with it. And actually, that I think is a good thing. Like, the spending of the Premier League and the fact that so many of these clubs lose money isn't a good thing. If that is corrected, if that brings a bit more rationality back to the market, and I'm talking about the player spending market, because that's really, let's be honest, where most of the money goes in football, then I also think that's a good thing. No one's properly settled on a good formula for how much of your revenue you should be spending on your playing squad, but it seems to me like pretty nuts that you could be spending upward of 75% of your total income on the squad when you've got, so, like, as you said, you've got so many other people that depend, like, that have livelihoods that depend on that business.
I suppose, I know Arsene Wenger used to call it financial doping, and in a sense it's similar to physical doping, I guess, with the transfer embargo argument, in that if you've assembled an extremely expensive squad that massively overspends, well, those assets don't go anywhere. You still own them. So I guess the transfer embargo actually doesn't necessarily hit its source, but maybe we'll continue that on another day.
I'm sure there will be many opportunities to have this conversation again.
I love getting toe-to-toe with you, Tom. Moving on and turning our attention to the other side of the Atlantic. As you know, Tom, this year I've made a real goal to watch more of the NFL. And although I am upset that my newly beloved Eagles lost in the initial wild card games, there are some interesting talking points from the first round of fixtures.
That was definitely one. I think maybe a few people saw that coming with the Eagles, and given their form in the second half of the season, chopping and changing coordinator positions and all of that kind of stuff. The Cowboys as well, going down at home to the Packers. That means that the Packers have now won more playoff games at the Cowboys stadium than the Cowboys have, which is a remarkable stat. I love stuff like that.
Not one you want to own if you're a Cowboy.
No, definitely not.
Penny for Aaron Rodgers' thoughts as well.
Yeah, his team missing the playoff. Although actually, I don't really ever want to hear Aaron Rodgers' thoughts. I've probably heard too much of them. It will probably be telling me to not get vaccinated and that, I don't know. Like, all of that stuff kind of on the field is great. I'm glad you're getting into it, GB. It is a great sport to watch, I think. And next weekend, I think, is probably the best weekend of the NFL season. You really get...
Really?
Yeah, this is the wheat from the chaff is finally gone. And you've got quality on quality. All four matchups are really, really high end.
I think it's time to start sacrificing the sleep schedule now. I can make it to halftime now, and I'm like, tomorrow's going to pay for this.
Yeah, Mondays have got to be written off, I think.
Apologies in advance to the senior leadership team at Sports and Media.
The big news, I guess, coming out of the NFL and one of its major broadcast partners in Disney is these reports that have emerged about the NFL acquiring a equity stake in the ESPN business, so that's the sports media business, with ESPN to take control of NFL media, which ties a bow on a few things that have been happening recently. There was some talks a while ago about NFL media being sold off. The NFL has recently cut a bunch of jobs. It cut a bunch of jobs at NFL media too. But also ESPN has been looking for an institutional partner, and there were talks about it being in discussions with a few of the leagues. This all comes against the backdrop of a switch over in model. So a switch from being a mostly pay TV focused business to being a direct-to-consumer business. That's set to happen in 2025. It wasn't just ESPN looking for this deal. And let's be clear, it's not even been confirmed by any party.
Advanced talks.
Advanced talks is the update here, rather than any kind of
PR parlance.
Anything concrete. And actually, there's not a lot of detail aside from the fact that NFL Media is a part of this. NFL Media, of course, was... NFL was looking for a partner for that. I think it's one of those things that, from the outside anyway, it looks like it works for all parties. I would be surprised if this weren't now to go ahead.
There hasn't been any indication of the percentage stakes between the equity, has there?
No indication on that. No really even indication on like overall deal value, which...
See, you can say the bigger number.
To get in another succession reference, it is a little bit at this stage, like I imagine any reporting will be a little bit, see who can say, congratulations on saying the bigger number.
Josh, obviously ESPN and D2C is almost a conjoined word at this stage, as they frequently talk up the ambition of going fully D2C by sort of 24, 25. Quite scary that we're in 24. But do you think this accelerates those plans, or at least is an important building block in those plans?
Yeah, ESPN could then sort of say they're the exclusive home of the NFL, at least their sort of side content. Not necessarily games, but yeah, I think it would sort of give them reason to think that they could attract a whole lot of paid subscribers, obviously NFL fans who then want to see the sort of on the shoulder content that NFL media already provides. It would definitely sort of give them a fire up to sort of say, hey, we may need to accelerate these DTC plans and sort of look at carving a home. And obviously the NFL is experimenting with DTC. We saw this weekend, you guys mentioned this weekend, they put a playoff game on Peacock for the first time. So it would definitely align with sort of everything that seems to be in ESPN sort of thinking at the moment.
ESPN, I'm guessing it's going to be ESPN Plus, but whatever the ESPN D2C product is, there's some really valuable things in here that NFL media brings, right? Like NFL Network, that's something that you can immediately plug and play. Red Zone, which is incredibly popular and a really great product, that can go straight into a product like this if you manage to pull this kind of deal off. And also NFL Plus, that thing of a rights holder moving its own OTT platform, and I think that's the differentiation with a D2C and an OTT platform, is that this is over the top NFL coverage, right, in a streaming form. But moving that within a bigger product, that's something as well that I think would be incredibly valuable to ESPN as part of that offering. And you just have to look at what the NFL means to the US media market. Like, the NFL made up, was it north of 90 of the top 100 broadcasts in the US in 2023? The NFL had an extraordinary number of those. Showing
I believe the other two outside of live games were like Draft Day and something else. It's total monopoly.
Yeah, it goes to show really that the NFL is the only thing that really matters in terms of like appointment viewing, live broadcast viewing in the US market. So,
and on my Sunday nights.
Yeah, increasingly so. If ESPN does that, this is something that really adds value to their D2C proposition. That's not very often I say this, but there was a very interesting chat on the Streamtime podcast last week with Dan Rayburn, where he talked about the kind of the value offer for and the mechanics of like how and why and what will work for ESPN in this future. And he was sort of saying it's quite vague, but this would be something that I think actually adds a bit of clarity to that situation.
Do you think this also marks a bit of a period of consolidation for Disney of their sports assets and de-risking some of their sports assets? So I know, obviously, Disney Star in India is also in advanced talks of their joint venture with Reliance Industries that would see Reliance take a 51% stake in the new entity. Do you see that as Disney essentially saying it's a trickier market than we first anticipated and we need to bring partners on board to de-risk it slightly?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think it's also a lot to do with some of those, those macro trends that we reference quite regularly, but I mean, really, truly, only really numbers people understand. But the fact that debt is a lot more expensive than it used to be is a factor here. The fact that the advertising market is cooled a little bit is a factor here. There are a few things that coalesce, I think. But yeah, I think you're right. It is a period of consolidation, and I think that's the result. I think that's a reaction to things that are going on, not just at the top of Disney, but broader in the media market and in their sort of the Disney world.
Yeah, and the challenges of the economics of streaming as well, right? It feels like both properties are having challenges with their direct consumer platforms. Obviously, Disney Plus Hotstar has seen a 25% subscriber churn post IPL loss, but I won't let myself get down that rabbit hole for now.
I was going to quickly say, because there was a report just before this one about the NFL buying an equity stake in ESPN, that ESPN advanced talks. It was a report from ESPN, funny enough, that they were in advanced talks to secure the college football playoff rights. And I mean, I'm sure there are people in the ESPN executive room, otherwise they can ask me for ideas, that have sort of made me dreaming up the possibility of sort of being able to do a doubleheader of college football and American football, because on that, we mentioned that top 100 list, there were three college football games that also made it into that list, and it does feel like ESPN may be sort of doubling down on sort of the properties that they know are a hit amongst the US population, and if not American football, it looks like college football is the second one to that, and if they're able to have the NFL involved and sort of do these sort of double headers or sort of manage to sort of package sort of both of them together, that just sounds like a huge win in terms of, again, attracting sort of the lion's share of the US population in terms of watching and stuff.
Owning December to February, as it were.
Yeah. And, that the NFL's stranglehold on the linear broadcast market is extraordinary, but you can see it's, at the same time, trying to diversify a bit more and put that business case together for the streaming platforms to say, what has been a huge success story on linear can also be that for OTT platforms. And you referenced it a minute ago, Josh, but that the playoff game between the Miami Dolphins and the Kansas City Chiefs in Baltic conditions, I might add, of minus 20 degrees, was a pretty pivotal milestone. It's exclusively streamed on Peacock. Could not be found anywhere else. Reported fee of just over $100 million.
That was the reported fee. There were lots of, if you went on, if the platform formerly known as Twitter on Sunday night, you'd have seen a lot of people complaining about Peacock, complaining about the quality of it, complaining about not being able to access it, that this is a scandal. To be fair, it was available in the local markets on NBC local affiliate stations. In Canada, it was available on the regular broadcasters. But yeah, for the rest of the American population, Peacock was where it was at. And one of the things that Dan Rayburn did say on the Streamtime podcast is that NBC is actually pretty good when it comes to reporting those numbers. So it probably is something behind them. That is a staggering figure, an average of 23 million, peaking at 28.
8 million more than, I think, Amazon's record of 15 and a bit.
You'd expect that for a playoff game. Like, it is a game which gets national attention. And if the tech largely held up, with the obvious caveat that if you're streaming to 23 million, some of those million aren't going to get the same quality. And that is actually still a challenge, I think, for people who see that as the future, is that at some point you need to have a technology which is as reliable as satellite broadcast, because satellite broadcast is still incredibly reliable. There is a reason why it's still the default, still the reason why it holds up the best when you've got that weight of strain on it. I don't think we're going to be seeing a Super Bowl exclusively on a streaming platform anytime soon, because I don't think the NFL would want, 5% of 100 million people having streaming issues. But if they're prepared to do it for a playoff game, that shows they think this is where it's going. And if NBC can pull it off to an extent, then that is impressive.
And what about the 100 million figure that's been quoted as the overall price to acquire the right? Do you think there's going to be a decent return on investment for Peacock there? Because obviously you had to be a subscriber to watch the game, but at the same time, you're going to expect enormous churn from those subscriptions.
I think so. I guess it depends if they keep it, and also what else they're able to offer. Like, I guess the other thing is that you've also paid a lot of money for additional data on a lot of people, and probably people that weren't going to be natural subscribers to a streaming service. So with older generations, less tech savvy folk, shall we say, these weren't the natural Peacock subscribers. But if you can get them into the ecosystem, you've got their details, you can market to them more directly now. You might have a chance to do some repeat business here. I'm in no position to project at what kind of like level of retention that will secure, but like, you got to think there'll be some. Will it be worth $110 million? I don't know, but it's if this is the direction that the industry is going in, and that seems like it is, then someone has got to make these kind of moves at some point.
Speaking of return on investment, Josh, I know this week you sat down with the team at Two Circles, having completed their deal with Charterhouse. So can you talk me through the sort of the overview of that deal? And I know we're going to hear your conversation with Gareth from Two Circles in just a minute.
Yeah, so it was announced last week that Charterhouse Capital Partners, a private equity firm based in London, had bought a majority stake in Two Circles, who, for those who are listening and don't know, they're a sports marketing agency, but also do provide a range of services, be it venue management, ticketing, sponsorship rights management, you name it. They've expanded considerably. This would mean that Bruin Sports Capital, who the fund that invested in Two Circles in 2019, would step away from the business. And yes, Two Circles, they said they will continue to be led by the same management team. Their management team have actually reinvested more money into increasing their own stake in the agency. And the reported figure for the Charterhouse's purchase was about £250 million, which we understand is a pretty accurate figure. And yeah, I spoke to Gareth just to understand a bit more about, you know, what has Two Circles done with Bruin, what is next for them with Charterhouse, and also we talked about what the agency landscape may look like in 2024.
Before we hear that interview, Tom, it feels like a pretty good deal for all parties. I know Bruin initially came in at $40 million, or reported anyway, back in 2019. So the private equity metric that I know is the gold standard is internal rate of return. Typically, I believe 20 to 25% is a very strong showing, and that's 60% from this deal. So good for Bruin, good for Charterhouse, obviously having the asset they want, and definitely good for the Two Circles management that have been there from day one.
It does look like a kind of win-win-win for all parties. And interestingly, Bruin seemed to have immediately gone and spent some of that money today on investing in a minority stake in Box to Box Films. So viewers of Drive to Survive can now bin any concerns that the company behind that will go out of business anytime soon, because they've just got a whole fresh new way of funding.
Well, yeah. They'd be quite happy about that.
Yeah, the makers of that will probably be very happy about that. It's funny how the money goes around in this world.
On that note, on that nice, optimistic note, Josh, let's hear your interview with Gareth.
Cool. So I am sports reporter Josh Sim, and I'm here with Gareth Bouch from Two Circles. And Two Circles have made the news because it was revealed last week that Charterhouse Capital Partners had bought a majority stake in the agency, taking over the stake that Bruin Sports Capital had owned prior to that. I wanted to sort of dive in because obviously this news came quite suddenly, I would say, in mid-January, to those who weren't aware, but I can't imagine that this came about from January 1st onwards. Do you mind sharing as much as you can about your experience from how the deal sort of was first conceived to, I guess, up until the point where it was announced last week? Do you mind sharing your perspective on it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we're delighted that the story ran last week because it was a culmination of a lifetime of hard work by our team in growing our clients' businesses. And we see it as a real affirmation of all that we've been growing in the 12 years since we started the business. Now, naturally, these things aren't baked up overnight and they require a fair amount of work. But we were really pleased that the first time this story had any resonance in the market was when it was done, as opposed to when it's being done. It was important to us that we found our new investment structure in a way that was off market, and we were really lucky to be full of inbound approaches and an awful lot of interest, which meant we were able to pick our way through that fairly discreetly and essentially not market the business through this process, which was really important to us. And we were very proud of the response we got from the investor community, and it was a real affirmation of sports future, of sports need to be fan-centric and data-driven. And by being a technology-enabled business in this part of the category, we've proven our ability to drive incredible returns for our clients, which I think in part enables someone like Charterhouse to feel confident to invest in us at this point, which we're really, really proud and delighted to take on board at this point.
I wanted to sort of dive into what this could mean going forward, but I'd love to sort of step back and see, because you guys have been with Bruin since 2019. I'm curious on your sort of personal reflections on how that time has gone, because it seems that Two Circles has taken huge steps forward with the support of Bruin. And I guess just giving the opportunity to reflect on that period, which has been a successful period for both parties, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. Look, Bruin are have been amazing partners to Two Circles and will be longtime friends to me and many of the leaders here. They've been brilliant people, and they know how to support entrepreneurs to achieve their goals. And that was a really big part of where our relationship was founded. Ironically, we completed the Bruin deal a week before COVID started. It didn't complete until 2020. And so our journey with Bruin really was pretty quick. You know, certainly, you know, less than 4 years in total was a relatively quick cycle, but we achieved an awful lot together, which says everything about the tenacity and the conviction with which Two Circles and Bruin were able to take on the opportunity that we saw ahead of us. And so, yeah, we're really grateful to Bruin. Obviously, there was COVID, which is boring to talk about, but everyone knows it changed much of those couple of years of our Bruin ownership cycle. What they gave us is the courage and the platform to be able to believe in our business being even better. And actually, I reflect on this because one does a lot of reflection at these points. I was reflecting on how much more confidence I've got in the future of Two Circles now than even I had at the point when we went into Bruin Capital. And anyone knows me, well, I'm a confident person, but I can see in the business and in the macro structures of sports that the opportunity for what we're passionate about doing, the opportunity to build a better future for the sports industry, one where more humans are consuming sport more often and for greater levels of avidity, creates this really rich, fertile era ahead of us. It will be a golden era for sports ahead of us. And that's why, essentially, as part of the leadership team here at Two Circles, this is essentially a management buyout of Two Circles to take it on to the next level. And what Charterhouse have done for us is similar to what Bruin did for us 3 or 4 years ago, which was create the platform, the conditions for success for us to be the best business we can be. And we're very excited about becoming that.
I was going to ask, was there a particular highlight or standout moment from your time with Bruin? But I suppose it's a standout period being sort of during COVID and post-COVID, because it was a time where I guess we were all sat at home and wondering what was next and having that sort of uncertainty in the short term. But you guys seem to do really well to sort of adapt to those circumstances and come out of it quite strong.
Yeah, look, I mean, it was amazing. I mean, we quadrupled the business, more than quadrupled the business, if you think about it through size in the period in which we were in Bruin. And obviously, you know, half of that period was during a form of COVID. There was one conversation George and I had before he completed the investment into Two Circles, where he instilled a level of belief and conviction in us around what we could go on to achieve. And he's worked in a lot of places around the world. He's been in a lot of environments. And he's a very experienced person. And we're relatively younger in our journey within our relative careers. And George helped me understand the level of potential that we had in the sports industry. And that conversation will stay with me forever, because there was a moment there where we stood back and said, hey, look, we're going to build a business. For us, it's about building a once-in-a-lifetime sports business. For everyone who's deeply involved in the leadership of Two Circles, this is our career. This is our life's work. This is our chance to build something that we think changes our industry forever, because there's this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity where there's a macro change in consumption and economics around sports. So the way in which fans consume sports and the way in which the world values it, and the clashing together of those things creates this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And George helped us see that. That conversation I had with him at the start of the Bruin cycle has stayed with me during all that time that's passed since, and informs much of the ambition you see from us at this point in Chart and another investment chapter.
You mentioned sort of the revenues going up tremendously, and I think the press release announcing the deal set quoted it as 450%. I'm curious if you can sort of help unpack, in what areas have you seen huge growth. I know you guys have worked hard to diversify your offering and services to your extensive client roster. Could you please help sort of unpack in what areas you've seen huge growth in and why, you know, I mean, 450% is an astronomical number.
I think what I'm more proud of is the growth that our clients have achieved in that period. And so the return on investments we're creating for our clients are both, of course, very data-driven and therefore highly measurable, but even greater than the returns that we've created. And that matters dearly to us. The number one way we've grown in this period is via the clients who were already trusted in Two Circles and the clients who've been doing a lot with us. So be it that our first ever client who continues to be a great partner for Two Circles and someone I'm really proud of the work we've done to transform the sport of cricket is the England and Wales Cricket Board. We continue to do more and more with England and Wales Cricket to help more people love cricket in this country and more people attain cricket in this country and ultimately also pick up a bat and ball. And the economic as well as societal impactful benefits we've created for the sport of cricket is something I'm really proud of. One of the key tenets of the way we've grown in this period is by growing the impact we have for our clients. In return, that means they've trusted us with bigger problems that they've had and we've done more for them, and that's been amazing. So the core anchor to that is our existing client relationships. 92% of clients that have ever trusted Two Circles for 6 months or more continue to be a Two Circles client today, and that means the world to us, and we deeply appreciate the trust they place in us as all their partners, and we try to return that by growing their businesses exceptionally. So the deal is a continued reflection of the commitment our clients make in us. So one of the ways we do it with existing clients, one of the other ways we've done this period of growth is through the acquisition of businesses that we believe both shared our cultural and spiritual beliefs in where the sports industry would go, but also enabled us to deliver even better solutions to our clients. We're obsessed about being the best company we can be, which means having the best solutions to tomorrow's opportunities in the sports industry. And what we've done with the coming together with some other founders who have essentially become business partners to Two Circles at this point is enabled us to have those best solutions to tomorrow's opportunities for the sports industry to grow. And so the acquisition of additional companies was a really big part of how we got here. And we've got some amazing business partners and leaders now taking forward the way in which sports sponsorship rights get taken to market, or the way in which you think about audience growth right across the audience funnel, all the way from a perspective broadcast viewer, all the way down to someone that I know intimately and have 10,000 data records on. And Two Circles is increasingly effective at going all the way through that audience growth chain. And then thinking about how we turn that into the growth of a sponsorship business, or the growth of a premium hospitality business, or the growth into an OTT business, or a growth into a merchandise business, and all these are facets of the business we've helped to build this set of capabilities that we think are the best capabilities that the industry needs for tomorrow's opportunities.
You've talked about sort of the growth of Two Circles up to now, and I definitely want to dive into what's future. But there was another thing I did want to ask about in the release, and it said that a lot of your hires, I think 75% of your hires, had come from outside the sports industry. And you talk about needing to cater to all these different services that these sports clients are now are looking at. Is that, has those hires or number of hires, has that reflected the need to diversify or pivot at certain moments to different other fields? I guess, why is that? Is basically what I'm asking.
Thank you for asking. I love talking about this. We've hired hundreds of people in the recent years. We'll be just shy of 600 Two Circlers by the end of quarter one, 2024. And actually the 75% from outside the industry was true in the brewing era of Two Circles, but it was also true in the 7 or so years that came before that, 7 or 8 years that came before that. We have been obsessed about the sports industry, taking people who know lots about it from within it. And I'm someone from within the sports industry. I used to work for Manchester City Football Club before I did this. I'm in the 25%. And we love finding the best that we can with people within the industry. But we know for the industry to be the best it can be, and for us to be the best business we can be, that we'll have to take the best talent from other sectors and create that cross-pollination of ideas where you get the diversity of thought to enable sport to become a fan-centric, data-driven, technology-enabled sector. We need to find the best from outside of sports. So nearly all of our technology team has come from outside of sports. So finding engineers and QAs and developers that are doing the best work for direct-to-consumer businesses outside of the sports and entertainment sector, and then pulling them in and harnessing their passions for sport. And we always hire against passion for sport, but we don't necessarily hire for aptitude of the sports industry, and asking them to bring the best of their sector. So a lot of our technology teams come from that. A lot of our creative teams have come from that sector too. We hire a lot of our strategy folk come out of 101 strat consulting world and a traditional strat consultant trained and bring all that complexity of how to approach problems and put them into simple solutions. So we've historically always brought the best from outside sport and fused it together through their passion for sport, and then put that into an environment that says, right, now let's change an industry forever. And the sports industry, in our opinion, shouldn't entirely pivot during this period of transformation it's going to go through and become a better product for the world, one that represents all the communities that sports serves, not just the narrow communities that it's historically served, and enable sports to blossom for all 8 billion humans in the world. And we are super excited about making that happen. And we believe that our people strategy is right at the center of how we do that well.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to your answer. I was going to ask about sort of take a step aside and look at a wider sports industry question. But in terms of the value of consumer data, you guys, as you mentioned, very data-driven. I guess this is something you're picking up from conversations with your clients as well, but and I feel free to sort of reiterate what you've just said earlier, but I guess it says a lot that it's moving in that direction at least. And sports properties are looking at ways in which they can gain more insights about their audience and their fan base.
Yeah, I mean, all of our clients have been pioneers in doing that. We've worked with sports organizations that are committed to being fan-centric, to being data-driven, and harnessing the ability to engage directly, scale with sports fans, and then reinventing their business models for that. And we've made it our business to become the best in the world at doing that. And we think in time that'll become the backbone of the whole sports industry, which essentially is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for us to be part of it. We're really privileged, highly determined to make the most of that opportunity. This news last week, which I thought was just a confirmation that our ambition to achieve that is greater than ever. And it's actually worthwhile thinking about Charterhouse in that regard, right? Because Charterhouse are a mainstream institutional investor who are cold, hard, rational money. This is not a investor who's got any track record or any inclination to do anything other than be cold, hard, rational investor, which sport has a bunch of those people in it. But the truth is, sports also historically had people who were essentially after the glory or the fame or the allure of sport, because it's a really attractive industry to people who are passionate about it. That's not Charterhouse's play. And Charterhouse is one of the longest established private equity companies in the world, have deployed billions of pounds. They came at this from a cold, hard, rational perspective. And I think this is a fantastic vote of confidence for the sports industry to continue to become more respected and investable to the broader investment community. And we're seeing this with the change in which the way that equities in sports are being traded. And there's lots of challenges around where we should be protective of that in terms of protecting the fact that sport ultimately is for societal good. But sport also will do the most societal good by being the most prosperous and indeed the most profitable it can, so that it can serve as wider audiences as possible. And having institutional investors be able to continue to believe in and prove out the value of sports, I think, is a data point that shows that we're getting more right than wrong in the sports industry. And we're going to see that, as has been the case certainly in the post-COVID years, we're going to see that increased number of institutional investors coming into sports, where there is that accountability around how you deliver brilliant returns that are all based on both data and all fans.
It's interesting you say that, and actually I guess I'll ask this question now, but your agency has obviously received an investment. We've seen Legends acquire ASM Global, obviously a venue management specialist. The market for these agencies and the interest in these agencies like yourselves who are providing services for the sports industries, it seems to have grown quite a fair bit in 2023. And I'm curious if you're convinced it continues to grow 2024 and beyond, and you're going to see more of these agencies receive more of this investment to sort of expand and continue as the sports business industry seems to also, you know, continue climbing up at a pretty fast rate.
Yeah, exactly. You've got it. I think Legends they're a fantastic business, and their ASM acquisition was a smart one. Ultimately, they're backed by Sixth Street, and Sixth Street, a bit like Charterhouse, are a cold, rational investor, institutional investor who have understood that the sports industry is inherently undervalued. And for those that approach the growth segments of the industry, they're going to have a fantastic period ahead and they want to participate in that. That's what we see in Charterhouse. Now, there's aspects of the sports industry, sadly, that are not set for growth. This isn't an all boats rise scenario over the period ahead. And in fact, it's going to bring some real challenges for how we ensure that sports continue to be the best they can be for all the communities they serve. But some aspects or some business models in the sports industry are under greater scrutiny and pressure than ever as other parts of that grow. And I think what we'll see, therefore, is either agencies consolidating because they see themselves under pressure, or indeed some really thriving and blossoming as the full extent of the changing consumption that we've seen from sports fans in the post-internet era really, really kick into to right cycles, and they kick into the reality of how executives need to view their businesses. And our belief, our energy and our commitment is to enable sports properties that we partner with to grow through that period and identify the strategies that enable them to grow by taking them to bigger audiences, more avid audiences, and being able to prove that and transact around that for the growth of their sport. And for the agencies, to take it back to your question, that I think are pivoting around those growth sectors, then it's going to be a fun and exciting few years ahead. We're certainly very optimistic.
Excellent. Well, I wanted to take it back to Two Circles specifically. And obviously, you know, whenever a deal like this gets reported, there's obviously, you know, people may speculate, oh, does this mean, does a change in ownership mean there's going to be change regards to the day-to-day or how, you know, a company that's being acquired or being invested in operates. But so I'm curious, I know it says that you and your management, your colleagues who lead the agency will continue to sort of do as you have done. But are there any challenges that come with this transition in ownership? And has this sort of had any impact on sort of your strategy or priorities that wasn't feasible maybe beforehand?
I sincerely hope there are not going to be any challenges. We are very optimistic this presents just a simple acceleration of what we were doing anyway. Hopefully for those that like having me around here at Two Circles and with our clients, I'm going nowhere and our leadership team is going nowhere. In fact, the opposite. Most of us have increased our shareholding at this point, not diluted it. We believe in the future of our business. And as a management team as a whole, we've collectively increased our shareholding and believe that all the best is yet to come. And this is the biggest or best affirmation we can have in the belief of what we're doing. We're here for the long run. This is our life's work. And this is just another step in the ownership chapter of Two Circles. And it's just simply a reflection of the growth that our clients are achieving and the growth that Two Circles are enabling for them. And I'm very proud to be part of that. And long, long, long may it continue.
Absolutely. And you mentioned, we talked about sort of agency consolidation, and you guys have obviously acquired entities like TRM Partners and Livewire and Codeware. And now you've got a bit more investment to play with Charter House. Does that mean, can we sort of see Two Circles in the market again, looking to acquire more sort of smaller companies and integrate them into your sort of wider operations? Is that something that we should expect to see going forward?
Yes, big and small. Anyone who's going to be collaborative and complementary to the vision we have for the future of the sports industry, we're going to be looking forward to having conversations and finding people who share the right values and share the right vision for the future of the industry. And I'd really hope the Two Circles can make some thoughtful acquisitions. And we're hugely proud of the four that we've been able to do over the last 3 years. And I think we'll find a few more to do if we're as thoughtful in the future as we have been in the past.
Great. And a similar question. I know you guys now have offices in LA and Melbourne and are starting to sort of, I mean, you already have an extensive roster that goes around the world. Does this also signal that you guys are looking to expand more globally and in other markets and countries that you've not yet had that sort of high level of involvement in?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're proud to add three additional offices during the Bruin era of, as you suggest, Melbourne, Los Angeles and Paris were the last three that we opened. We anticipate to do more of that. We're most interested in going into markets where our clients need or want to understand sports fans most intimately. And there's, you know, many markets that we don't do that as well as we'd love to do that. So we're driven by where our clients, the opportunity for global expansion of their own audiences to get that understanding of localization, then we'll be really thoughtful to think about, okay, where can we then support in doing that more effectively? And we're big believers in, you know, to grow fans in new markets, you need to intimately understand them. And clearly data takes you a long way there, but the human side of that is absolutely critical, and therefore we'll humanize through a localized approach. And I suspect we'll have many more than six offices because we also love in-person working, and therefore offices are important to Two Circles. Not that we mandate them, but we do encourage them, and we find that to be a really effective way for our Two Circlers to come together and to collaborate. So I suspect we'll have several more offices in the Charter House era of Two Circles.
Great. I know we've sort of just touched on two aspects of where Two Circles may grow going forward, but I want to sort of leave it an open forum, if you like, to sort of talk about any other areas in which you expect there to be growth that we haven't mentioned, or what, I guess, you know, in terms of a bigger picture, where do you see and hope Two Circles goes going forward? Feel free to sort of outline that.
Yeah, thank you. I'll do my best. Look, Two Circles is going to, as I said earlier, be the best business we can be for our clients. That's been our ambition from the start, and this is a reaffirmation of that ambition. For us, that means our ability to spot what the opportunities are tomorrow for our clients to grow and curate the capabilities that are going to enable us to get there. So we think today the sports properties in totality generates about £150 billion worth of revenue a year. We think that number will be nearer £220 billion by the end of the decade. And our ambition is to become the best people in the world at creating and finding that value on behalf of our clients. And what we're going to do is be relentless and obsessive about finding those solutions and creating those opportunities. That might be investing alongside our clients. That might be in partnering for the long term, like we have a number of them. That might just be being the best arms and legs we can be to help us get there quicker. What that will mean is that we're going to serve audiences in ways that have never been thought about before. And we're going to take beautiful and amazing sports and we're going to present them to the world in a way that reflects all the segments of the potential market, not just the most avid markets that have gone before. That means we're going to look at economic models and identify leakage, and we're going to find ways to deliver those economic models more efficiently so that the rights holder can participate in more of the value that they create. And we'll do all of that in a data-driven, technology-enabled way, because that's the only way. I think if we do that well and we stick right in the heart of it, the Two Circles spirit, that anyone who spent more than 5 minutes around Two Circles will hopefully know what I mean when I talk about the Two Circles spirit, and we stick that spirit right in the heart of this, that we're here for sport, to create value for sport, then I think we'll have the ride of our lives.
Great. And just finally, just from a wider, I mean, I was going to ask you, because we're still in January, it's still predictions window, I suppose, for 2024. I guess you sort of outlined that you feel sport's going to double down on the data revolution that it's going under. I don't know if there are any other predictions that you can sort of make, or things that you think will happen in 2024 that maybe we haven't seen, or maybe that started to sort of be trickled out last year, but could, you know, receive more attention, I guess, in 2024.
Well, 2024 is a Summer Olympics year, which we are overdue. As a world, we are overdue a spectacular Summer Olympics. I think what we'll see this summer is a spectacular Summer Olympics in Paris. And I'm personally hugely looking forward to that. I'll be there with my family, enjoying it as a fan more than anything else. And hugely looking forward to the world descending on Paris later in the year. I think that'll be a spectacle in the way that only the Olympics can be, in its way to show all the best of humanity together. I'm really looking forward to that. I think we'll see the acceleration of AI into business. I'm one often to call out where I think there's hype with no substance. There's hype and a lot of substance around AI, and I think it will revolutionize the way we create and distribute content for our clients, but I think it will do that for the rest of the world. It'll also revolutionize the way we process data. I see there's huge changes in the way that data is harnessed to drive commercial models, and we're seeing it mostly from the buyers, not necessarily from the sellers. Like, sports rights holders have been helping to think and talk about the use of first-party data in more effective ways, but what I'm so excited about is the way that brands and broadcasters are increasingly talking to us about the way in which they want to use first-party data as a currency to deliver value on their investment in sports. And I think the runway for that is in its infancy, and we're excited about seeing that come to its maturity.
I'm sure we can have this chat in a year's time and see how many of these you get right. Or I'm sure if not this year, then a lot of the things you've talked about may come about going forward. But Gareth, thank you so much for joining us on the Sports Pro Podcast. It was a really interesting conversation, and good luck with everything Two Circles going forward.
Thank you, Josh, and thank you, Sports Pro. You do a great job for our industry. We really appreciate it.